This is Jasper Francis. I'm here with Bill Hughes Jr. on Thursday, March 12th, 2026. We are in the Hudson Area Library History Room for an oral history interview as part of the HAL Oral History Project. Bill, thank you so much for joining me.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Sure. Bill Hughes, formal name is William Hughes Jr. Born 10/28/1965 in the city of Hudson at 12 Warren Street. In the Columbia Memorial Hospital to my parents, Francis Hughes and William Hughes Sr., and lived in Hudson my entire life, and I'm 60 years old now. So,
wonderful. Tell me a little bit about your childhood here in Hudson.
Oh, boy. So, my grandmother had 14 kids, and my father was the fourth of those 14. And so my oldest aunt, my Aunt Shirley, she had 12. My Aunt Mary had 9. The next oldest, Mocha Buck, had 7. And my father had 4. And it just went on and on for them. So I tell you that to preface that is that I grew up with hundreds of first cousins. And we were all very close. And as I was growing up, we were really all concentrated. For the first 5 years of my life, we were all concentrated from Front Street to Second Street. So we all lived in the lower half of the city of Hudson. And my family was and still is very, very, very close. All of them, cousins, aunts, uncles, the ones still living, were all very close. And, you know, we grew up around family, picnics, you know, togetherness. It's a big part of the Hughes family. So I have to say I wasn't rich monetarily, but we were very rich in community and in loving family.
So of your siblings, what's the birth order for you? Because you have 4 siblings, your father has 4 children?
4 children. Mm-hmm.
So your oldest, youngest, somewhere in the middle?
I'm the oldest. And then I have my next sister is Wanda. And then I have my youngest sister, Sierra. And then we have a half-sister, Sue, by a different mother. Same father.
Is a lot of your family, your siblings or your cousins still here in Hudson?
No, actually. I still have a few in Catskill, on the Brantley side, which was the first born on the Hughes side. And I still have some in Hudson, but the majority are now in Albany. And I think that has to do a lot to do with the economy.
All right. So growing up, you lived at 12 Warren Street. I guess you've seen Warren Street shift a lot, especially in like the last 20 or so years. What has that been like?
Quite amazing, actually, because I moved from Warren Street, from 12 Warren Street to 307 State Street when I was about 6. And when we moved from Warren Street to State Street, I actually cried. And I can remember the whole time is because I thought they moved us out of Hudson. Because when we lived over on Warren Street, that section of Warren Street, there was a drugstore called Waddell's. There was a candy store that was across the street, Mr. Ted's. And then on the store on the corner, there was a grocery store called Lipschutz, where you can go in, you can get fresh cut meats and that kind of thing. And then just up the block, you have Frontino's, where you can get subs, root beer floats and all that. And then right across the street from that, you had a pizza shop. So you didn't have to leave the block. Like there was, and right behind my house was Franklin Park. So we had the waterfront, we had the parks, Promenade Hill. We used to go over there and have picnics all the time. The fire company was always active. The Washington Hose Fire Company, which is now the Chamber of Commerce. Was always active, and they used to do these bazaars where you can go and get fried dough and all that. So that whole area was very lively. So when I left that to go up to a single-family home in a single family neighborhood, which was really only a block away, I thought I was in a whole nother city. And it was like, what the heck just happened? Right? And so as I got older and I was able to realize, you know, now you get, I'm like 10, 12, so now you can realize surroundings around you. There was just a ton of factories, but you could see each factory closing down. Like the dress factory was the first one I recognized that closed down. And then you had this other factory that was over on Union Street, and I forgot what that one was. But then that one went down. And then you would hear the stories of how the Candy Lane factory closed down and the Mushroom factory closed down. But there were still factories in Hudson. Like the cement plant was still here, the Atlas cement plant, and the pocketbook factory and the match factory were still here. And so Warren Street was lined with a bunch of bars, but there was also bars off of Warren Street, State Street, Robinson Street. There was really like a bar on every corner. And Warren Street was really busy, but it was busy with working class people. You know, you didn't have this rich, affluent class. It was somebody that would go to work, get off work, run to the bar, have a quick drink, then run over to one of the little shops there and get a hot dog, or you'll go get I used to go to J.G. Newberry's, and you can get a soda and a fries for 50 cent, you know, and so I had 50 cent and I go out there and I get soda. If I had a dollar, I could get soda, fries, and then two packs of baseball cards. That was like a big deal for us, you know. And then you saw that transition when I became in eighth grade. So when I was like 15 to 16, you saw that the degradation of Warren Street, where it fell into, because now you're talking, you know, early 80s. Coming into the early 90s, late 80s, coming into the early 90s. And you start to see the crack era, all the buildings being boarded off, a lot of police raids on the community. You know, people were scared to death to walk up and down Warren Street. Like, it was the rumor, only the brave, you know, would dare to walk down Warren Street. You know, it was like that kind of thing. And all these stores started moving away. J.J. Newberry's went away, Jupiter's went away. You had Tom McCann's, the Army Navy store where we used to go get our sneakers, Lee's clothing store. All these stores started closing down one by one, and all these buildings started to get into real disrepair. And Warren Street was no longer, you know, it was no longer thriving or beacon of the city. It was more of the appendage of the city where, you know, you didn't want to go over on Warren Street because it was dangerous. And then right around 95 or a little later than that, you started seeing just one by one a glimmer of these stores coming in that were doing, and we didn't know what it was, but they were doing like these antique, you know, we were like, what is that? You know, as a kid, we still didn't understand, you know, what are they selling? It doesn't look like they have selling anything, right? But they seemed, they were popping up one by one by one. And then you started getting these bars, but it wasn't the traditional bar that we were used to. It was, you know, because the bars we were used to is, like my father, you know, one of these blue collar guys that went to work and you go over there and all the guys sat around and drank beer and did shots. Now these bars were a little more sophisticated. And then you started getting what we saw as the movement of the gay crowd, which shocked the heck out of us. I mean, because when I grew up, everybody in the community, whether you were black, white, or different, were very conservative. Hudson was like, when I say, I mean super conservative. So that initially shocked us. And we saw this playing out on Warren Street to the point to where Warren Street had gotten to the point where you started seeing now some of these properties that were boarded up. Some families didn't have a problem with it because above those properties, you could get a cheap apartment. Yeah. It wasn't a great apartment, but it was a cheap apartment. And when these people started moving in and rehabbing these buildings, they were clearing a lot of people out of these buildings. And as that happened, the rents were shooting up to the point to where it caused a real divide in the city of Hudson, one that still exists today. But the divide, that initial divide, was pretty bad to the point to where I tell people this. You can look at the divide on Hudson. You had the south side and the north side. And this is the north side where we are now. North 5th, 6th, right? So we're on North 5th Street. The south side, which is, if you split Warren Street in half, on the south side of Warren Street, going over, so it would be Warren, Union Street, and Allen Street. When you went on that side of the city, it became the affluent part of the city. When you came on the north side, it was Columbia Street, State Street, and then like side streets like Robinson. That was still more the old population, who weren't necessarily poor, but middle class, right? The blue-collar working family guy was on that side of the city. And it really started to build up a lot of tension. So by this time, I was at a school, and years later, I ended up getting into politics. And one of the initiatives I was really fervent about is I was going to be the bridge between the south side and the north side. And that was one of my goals that I had set when I got elected to office.
Just to contextualize it for people listening, what year did you get elected?
2003.
And what position was that?
City Alderman.
City Alderman, thank you. How did that go for you, like bridging the division?
So here's a story in itself. So I'm legally blind. I have glaucoma. I had glaucoma since I was 5. I was initially diagnosed with cataracts. And in order to remove the cataracts, they had to give me, it was really a rudimentary kind of surgery, because I had my surgery in 1970. So they actually had to take me in the hospital, use a scalpel, and I had a 2-week recovery. So I had to stay in the hospital two weeks recovery from cataract surgery. As a result of the cataract surgery, I developed glaucoma because of the scar tissue that was built up. And from then, I started losing my peripheral vision. So right around 5th grade, I really started developing glaucoma, and nobody knew what it was. So by the time I hit 8th grade, I had lost about 70% of my peripheral vision. And we only discovered it by luck, kind of. I was playing baseball, and this kid hit a fly ball to the outfield, and I took off running for the ball. And I didn't see the person standing in the field, and I ran him over. And the coach was like, "You didn't see him stand there?" And I said, "No." So they sent me for a review with the doctor, and he was shocked. My pressure in my eye was like 50-something, which is normal is 20. And so I had to go into emergency surgery for corrective action. But by that time, I lost almost all vision. I have no vision in my right eye right now. So I lost almost all vision in my right eye, and about 80% at that time in my left eye. Now I'm down to about 10%. So I say that to preface this is, once it was determined I was legally blind, I, going through high school, thought that I was gonna go into the military. That was my ultimate dream. I was gonna be an officer in the Marine Corps. Didn't wanna do anything else other than being an officer in the Marine Corps. I took the ASVAB. I did fairly well on that. I did the physical, went to Albany, met all the people up there. And then when it came time to do the physical, the doctor got snowed out that day and couldn't come, so I had to come back for a follow-up. And when I did, they were like, "We can't let you in." So I was mad at society over that. And truthfully, I was mad at God, because up until then, I didn't know. I mean, I knew I was different, but I didn't know that I had something that was going to actually hold me back from being able to do things. And I should have known, though, because in my senior year in high school, I signed up for driver's ed, and the school wouldn't allow me to take the driver's ed class. because they didn't think I would be able to see good enough and the insurance wouldn't be able to cover me. And also in my junior year, they wouldn't allow me to play football because my doctor wouldn't sign off. But I never connected the dots that this was going to be a continuing thing and it was going to affect me in life. You know, I was just like, I can still do everything that everybody else is doing. So when I went and applied for the military, I'm thinking that this was a done deal, right? I'm military and I'm off. And when that didn't happen, I got so angry with everybody shut down. Now, my father is an ex-military. He's ex-Marine. So he wasn't giving me any of that pity-patty, you know, feel sorry for yourself kind of thing. In fact, he was pretty hard on me. And he was like, look, I don't care what you do. You're going to get a job or move out of this house. So I ended up working at Burger King. And I worked at Burger King for quite a few years, 17 to be exact. But I was into working at Burger King, I want to say about 5 years, and Walmart moved into the area. So when I started at Burger King, I was making $3.35 an hour. And I hadn't gotten to the point to where I'm running the restaurant. Like I was the guy in the restaurant. So I loved the job. I really did. It didn't pay me anything. So I applied for a job at Walmart and was hired on the spot. And they wanted me to be a day clerk. So a stocker stocking the shelves. So what my job was working there at 5 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. So what I decided I would do is I would change my schedule at Burger King and work 9 p.m. to 5 a.m, then walk from Burger King and get to Walmart by 5:30 and work 5:30 to 2:30, then walk home, sleep, and then repeat that. And I had Saturday and Sundays off, so I scheduled it so I didn't have too many overlapping days. And I did that for 2 years. But as I was walking home from Walmart, one of my father's good friends, and who's a family friend to this day, Mr. Grandinetti, stopped me and was like, hey, you want to work for the county? And I said, I don't know. What does the county do? And he said, come see my wife, who was in politics at the time. And I was like, okay. So I go over there, and they're giving me the whole thing about I can take this job, and it'll be part-time. And I was like, look, I'm already working 2 full-time jobs. I don't need another part-time job. And they're like, look, this part-time job is going to pay you more than your full-time job. And I was like, no way. And they were telling me, well, it's paying $16 an hour. I was like, what? What am I supposed to do? You know, so now my ears is buzzing. And so I decided I wanted to do the job, but I came up with another brainstorm. I said, hey, what if they allow me to do weekends? And they were like, you want to work weekends? I was like, yeah, because I could keep the other 2 jobs. So there was a period of time where I was doing all 3 at once. And in that time, I became so good at the county, they had me training all the people who were full-time and let them go full-time. So I approached the management and I said, hey, you know, how do I get to be full-time? And they said, well, go see the person who sponsored you, which was Miss Grandinetti. I went and saw her and they started getting to this whole thing about, well, do you vote? Well, yeah, I vote. Well, you know, are you registered? I said, I believe so. You know, I registered in high school. So I didn't know what party I registered on, but I knew I had registered. And I was like, I'm positive I registered. And they say, do you know what party you registered? And I said, I don't. So I ran over to the Board of Elections and I asked the woman, and I said, can you tell me what party I'm registered in? And she said, old lady, her name was Marguerite Van Vakis. And she had to be like 75 or so. And she comes over and she's like, you're a Democrat, of course. And I was like, what the heck does she mean by that? You know, and because I wasn't political at the time. I had no idea. I only did it because my family said, hey, you got to register. So I go and I tell them and I said, hey, I'm a Democrat. Is that a problem? And they were like, I said, okay, I'll be right back. So I run back over to the Board of Elections and the woman is coming. And I said, hey, I'd like to change my party. And she said, to what? I said, well, what's the two biggest parties in Columbia County? And she said, well, there's Democrat and Republican. I said, okay, well, which one is running the county? And she said, the Republican. I said, I'd like to be a Republican then. And she was like, are you sure? And I said, yeah. And she said, why are you doing this, for a job? I said, I hope so. And I changed my party, and I had her give me a photocopy of my registration. I take that over, you know, to the people, and they called me a couple of days later and said, you know, report to your job. And I had no job title, no interview, no physical, nothing. And I just go in there, and I now work in a full-time job at the county. And then I started building relationships with people, and got close to a lot, really close to the Republican side. And they realized that, A, I came from one of the three largest, if not the largest family in Hudson. And my family was very respected and had a lot of ties. And they were like, you know what, you should run for politics. And I was like, I'm only here to make money. If it ain't making money, I don't want nothing to do with it. And they were like, well, you could do a lot of good for your community. And I was like, what good could I do? And they were like, well, you know, you can help, we allocate funds, we distribute money here and there. And I said, well, okay, tell me a little more about that. And as they started explaining it to me, I was like, well, that's something to admit. Because I've always been, my whole family has always been community oriented. So I was like, okay, if I can help the community, I'll do that. So I actually run for office and win. But once I got there, I didn't realize that there was a real difference between the Republican and Democrats when you're an elected official. As a general person walking around here, most people don't know what party you belong to. They assume, but they don't know, right? But once you're elected and sitting in that room, and you now have to push forward the policies that the party is ushering in, then you quickly realize that you're on one side or the other of that fence. And as I was sitting there, after about a week or two, I was really questioning whether I was sitting on the right side of the fence. Because some of the things they wanted me to do and push for, and I'm like, I don't believe in any of this. None of this stuff. So we really don't align. But I also wanted to make sure I appeased them so that I could keep my job. And actually not only keep my job, but, you know, progress in my job. So that's kind of the long version of how I went from my childhood into politics. I had no intention of ever running for politics, to be honest.
All right, thank you. And how long were you involved in county government?
So I did 4 years in the city from 2003 to 2007, and then I ran for county supervisor 2007 to 2017.
All right, thank you. What was your experience like working in both of those positions? I mean, I feel like you must have seen the city and the county changed quite a lot in those 14 years in total, was it? 2003 to 2017?
Yeah.
What was that experience like?
Like going to college. Because I didn't formally go to college, and I tell people this all the time. It was, I bet you I probably, when it came to policy and budgets, more educated than most people to go to college. Because you quickly start to learn how money moves through government, the horse trading that goes on, the different acronyms that people use, the games that are played within the hiring process. You quickly start to see a lot of that, and you could take one or two paths. And this is how I always mentor people who are going to political office now is. You can pick the path of, I am going to go to a meeting, I'm going to be a disruptor, and I'm going to vote yes or no and go home, not offering any solutions. Or you could be that politician that want to get something done by learning the process, understanding the language, most important of anything possible is learning how the money moves through the system and then offer solutions for the things that you don't like. So if I don't like taxes in my community, instead of me saying, hey, don't tax the people, knowing that we as a city need to bring in revenue, I'm saying, hey, let's tax the people differently and let's do it this way. So I'm offering solutions for a problem that for a situation that I don't like, versus coming in and just blowing it all up and walking away to leave it for someone else to fix. That's one. So, and that's on the city level. On the county level, and this what frustrated me most when I served in office, the average person walking around the community have no idea what their elected officials do. And I used to explain to them, and I'm like, look, when I was on the city level, I advocated for you about your water bill, trash, police coverage, community safety, parks and playgrounds, and things of that nature. At the county level, it is services. Office of the Aging, Department of Social Services, your Veteran Services, DPW, Department of Motor Vehicle. These are all services. I have nothing to do with your water bill. I have nothing to do with your property tax. I have nothing to do with your school tax. Just services. And a lot of people used to come to me and be like, well, if you can't help me with my property tax, but I have nothing to do with that. That's your alderman, right? Or if you can't help me with that fee I'm getting, you know, in the DMV office, I'm like, DMV offers the service, the fees and all that are set at the state level. That's your state official. And so I used to sit there and get frustrated trying to explain that to people a lot. But I also became very well versed at the county level, probably more so than most of, I think, not to brag, but more so than most of, I think, our supervisors sitting there. And I learned how to really advocate and fight for programs to direct funds towards my community, which before I got there, had never gotten any funds, or very little. And that's only because I realized how the funds and programs were established. You know, for example, when I came there, I helped establish the Greater Promise Neighborhood, right? And I was able to get funds from the county and also the city to help, you know, to help get them started. The re-entry program within Columbia County, I got the county to pay for that initial startup of that program. The Greater Promise AmeriCorps, I got the county to give the money to the Mental Health Association to write the grant. The mentor program that's being run out of the Mental Health Association, I got the county to pay the money to initially start that program, the opioid program. Again, I'm the one that helped or really pushed Columbia Green or Columbia County to merge with Green County, because I approached the state about giving us funding and they told us we didn't have enough numbers. And I said, okay. And we don't have enough numbers in Columbia County. What if we combine Columbia and Green County? And they said, well, maybe that might work. And so we fought hard and we did that. And then we actually qualified for state funding. So I understood the funding and I understood the mentality of the Republicans, right? What most people have to understand at the local level, I can't speak to the federal level. At the local level, most Republicans aren't that different from us. Right, we were raised in the same community. We went to the same school. Their parents may have a little difference in ideology, but they all want the same thing: good education, a roof over their head, and to be able to have a good living for them and their kids. We all want the same thing. How we get there is where we differ. But on the local level, so when I would present a program, I would tell them, "Do you think this program is only for my kids? Your kids and grandkids are going to need this service too." And they're like, yeah, maybe you're right. And they would give me the money. But you had to put it in their face and show them. Like when I worked on the reentry program, right, they couldn't believe, oh, we don't want to fund more criminals coming into Columbia County. And we don't want, and I said, oh, really? And we just had to have, it would just so happen that I ran into this kid that was getting released from Columbia County, from the prison. And he's being released, and he was a young man that belonged to a prominent Republican family in Columbia County. So I brought his name up in the meeting and I said, hey, this young man is being released right now, in my opinion, is someone that deserves a second chance. I think many of you in this room would agree. And someone went down their head and I said, and that's exactly what I'm talking about. Somebody like him getting a second chance. We're not talking about just run-of-the-mill criminals that we don't know. We know this young man. Just like some of these other people that you know in this community that should have a second chance. So why shouldn't we have a reentry program? And at that time, the chairman was like, I agree, Bill. And he gave me the money to help them start the program. But you had to put it in their face and show them that we're not just throwing money out the window. We're here to serve people, regardless of their party affiliation.
You mentioned like a couple of different programs that you worked on and advocated for, mm-hmm. the Greater Promise Neighborhood Program, Reentry, the opioid program with the CGMHA, all really fantastic stuff that you've done for the community. Is there anything else that you worked on during your years in government that you'd like to kind of highlight?
Yeah, so remember when with that all that stuff with George Floyd and, you know, hands and so there was a real push for police reform. So I was like, you know, how can I make a difference as a legislator in police reform? So I approached Greg Mosley, who was a retired state trooper who had reached the, I want to say the rank of colonel, but I know at least lieutenant, but I believe he reached the rank of either a lieutenant or colonel with the state police. And he was in charge of minority recruitment at that time, and he retired. So I was like, you know what would really change police departments? It's not changing the policy. We need to change the mindset. And the only way you could do that is to diversify some of these police agencies or law enforcement agencies. And the only way the problem we have is we could come out here and say you need to hire more cops. But the truth of that is these young men and women need to be qualified for us to recommend their names. And so I was like, okay, that's where the pinch point is. How do we get more people in our communities qualified so that we can even offer their names? Because right now we can't, even if the sheriff came and said, okay, give me two candidates. We couldn't give him two candidates because we had no one that met the qualifications. So what we said is, you know what, let's start a program that will train youth in our community, on the qualifications of becoming or participating in law enforcement at all levels, whether it was working in 911, or whether it was working in the correctional officers, or whether it was working in the office on the administrative side and like the DA's office, or actually being on the road as a police officer. We wanted you to see all facets. So we started this program called LEDI, L-E-D-I, Law Enforcement Diversity Initiative. In the first class, we had 19 kids that showed up of all backgrounds. And it was directed for minorities only. And that actually rubbed a couple officers the wrong way, one in particular, and he came up to me and he told me, which I appreciate. He said, you know, Bill, there are a lot of other people in our community who would like a program like this as well. And I said to him, look, this isn't racial, but let me explain it to you from my perspective. You're in law enforcement, right? And I said, how did you get there? And he goes, well, you know, my uncles and my father. Great. I said, and I bet that's the same for a lot of other people who are in law enforcement who you know. And he goes, yeah. I said, which then now leads to my very point is there's doors open to you because you knew people who look like you, who made sure they opened doors so you had an opportunity. In our community, there's no doors to be open because show me another police, a black or brown police officer that you know. Show me one. So they're not opening up any doors. So we have to provide a door for them so that they can even walk through and even think about the opportunity. Because right now, they can't even think about the opportunity. They just don't have the skills and qualifications for it. And so that's what we're trying to provide. And he attended, like, the first two classes, and after that, he actually became a volunteer for the program.
That's wonderful. Thank you for telling me about that program.
Good.
Looping back a little bit, so you said that when you first entered city politics as an elected official back in 2003, part of your motivation was seeing the divisions that were taking place in Hudson between South and North, between affluent and middle class or poor, and then I think we could also say between like conservative and liberal. How do you feel about those divides today, 20 years later? Do you feel like things have improved or gotten worse?
It's gotten worse. It's because we allow people at higher levels to foment, and really, so we were, at one time, we were divided on, I want to say ideologies, right? You know, the local Republicans fought and believed in this, and the local Democrats fought and believed in that. Like I said, there was never really much divide. Where the divide was, the jobs, right? The party who was in control controlled the jobs. That was back then. Today, there's a true feeling of divide. Like, there's a lot of anger going around. You have people that are anti-gay, and you know, you always put those labels on it now. They're anti-black or anti-trans, or now we're even getting into religion, or anti-Muslim, or we're anti-Jewish, and we're anti. It's so much because of all the labels. Sometimes you always say, well, how am I going to bring all these people back together again? Because at some point, we as a country need to come back together, because a country divided is easy conquered, right? And it's the same thing for communities in towns. So if we can't come back together, we're going to struggle as society. So I think we're way much, much worse off now than back when I was a kid.
What do you hope for the future of Hudson when it comes to that? What do you think could be done to kind of unify us as a city, as a county, on a larger scale, as a country?
So,
I'm big actually, question, I know.
I'm a big idea kind of person. And I'll give you the scoop on, I'm actually looking to start a, because a lot of people are really asking me to move back to Hudson full time, because I have a house also in Ward of Elite, and I travel back and forth, and I usually come here on Tuesdays and leave on Fridays. That's generally my schedule. So I'm spending Friday night till Monday morning or Monday evening in Albany, and then I'm down here for the other rest of the week. But a lot of people are trying to get me to move here, you know, Monday through Friday and run again. And I was like, I never wanted the title. I didn't need to have the title to the, you know, project power and all that. I now know enough to where I can do good work, either working alongside the politicians or working in spite of them. I know more than a lot of them sitting there. I know where the resources are. I don't need to be an elected official to get them. So that being said, is I'm gonna here in a little bit, start a think tank committee. And in that committee is not to be against any political person, any political party, but more to work on solutions to issues that are plaguing specifically the city of Hudson, but also the county, the county as well. And the first one I'm looking at is housing. They have a meeting tonight, right, where you have some agencies that are opposing them increasing the days that people can rent out for Airbnb. Well, I disagree with that. And people, well, why? You support more affordable housing. I don't think that you can legislate affordable housing on investors. I don't. Because if I, as an investor, and I come in and I buy a property, a duplex property, not a single family home, if I buy a duplex property and I decide I want to Airbnb that out, and you say, no, I'm going to put limits on that with the hopes that you're going to make that long-term rental, and that long-term rental is going to be affordable housing, I, as an investor, am telling you that, A, I have enough money to where I could just leave it empty, or it's not going to be affordable. It may be a long-term rental, but my rent is going to be, I'm going to need it to make sense numbers-wise. So I'm going to charge $2,000 to $3,000 a month, which is probably out of the affordable housing range that these advocate groups are looking for. So to try to legislate an investor into affordable housing is not what we need to do. If we want affordable housing, we need to advocate and create policies that direct affordable housing. And how we do that is you create packages. You create a pilot program, tax incentives, and areas in which you would accept affordable housing. And then you approach developers and say, hey, I have this land over here. We're willing to give this pilot that comes with this tax credits that will allow you to set up these many apartments in this area. That's how you get affordable housing. You're not forcing someone to try to do it. You're actually advocating for the person that wants to do it. So that's step one. The other thing is I'm going to call for, and I've already talked to other people in the community, call for the closing of the Hudson Correctional prison. One, the census is way down. I don't think that land is probably the most valuable land in Columbia County right now. There's close to 200 acres. We probably could put 600 units of housing there. And in that case, I wouldn't be advocating for rental housing. I would want them to develop that with the majority of the property going towards a first-time home buyers program, affordable first-time home buyers programs. So if you had some people that were able to come in and build, let's say, housing that was in the $250 to $450 range, $50,000 range, right? Will you make that very affordable for a starter home or someone that had a job but still didn't have enough money to get into the $600,000 or $800,000 home, right? And you could bring that middle class family back here to Hudson, and that does two things, right? You're creating affordable housing for kids who are just starting out in careers, getting out of college, where they can buy a home and start a family, start a home. But because you added 5 or 6 or however many hundreds more homes, you're spreading the tax base more. So you're able to actually bring the tax rate down. So that's another big issue. And the biggest issue of all is I would love to see Hudson and Greenport merge and become one city. Now, that's a much bigger task and a much bigger job, but that's something that I would like to work on. And I don't need to be an elected official to do that. The process of whether to do that is the legislature of Greenport and the legislature of Hudson can pass a resolution to put that on the ballot so that we can merge, or I could just get 10% of the population in Hudson to sign a petition and 10% of the population in Greenport to sign a petition and put it on the ballot that way, through a public referendum. So,
is that something you've already been talking to other people about And are you getting a lot of positive responses?
I've been getting mixed feedback. No negative.
Okay.
People are they're worried about it because they're thinking, especially in Greenport, right? Because Greenport is thinking they're on a different island than Hudson, right? They're looking at it and saying, why would we want to take on Hudson's problems? And I said, first and foremost, Hudson doesn't really, our problems that you say are problems is we're too crowded. It's not that we're low on money. We actually have a very affluent crowd here. You in Greenport, you have a lot of the lower income people, families who actually lived in Hudson got pushed out to Greenport, right? So a lot of people who actually live down in Hudson, downtown Hudson, including a lot of my family members, live in Greenport. Apple Meadows, the mental health housing that has been put out there, or the single family housing because it's half the price, right? I said, but you guys have a zoning problem and a traffic problem, right? And half your shopping centers out here are empty, right? Because you just don't have any patronage coming out here, so these places can't afford to pay the rent. But if Hudson and Greenport merged and it became one big city, the funding streams that come from the state and federal government are now different, right? You as Greenport aren't entitled to that funding right now because you're a town. But if you were to merge with the city of Hudson, you're now entitled to other funding that Greenport right now is fighting to have, which I believe should happen. They're fighting to have Fairview Avenue, the length of Fairview Avenue, become a four-lane highway. It absolutely should happen. But because they're a town, nobody's really, and you're not a large town, population-wise, right? Geographically, you're big, but population-wise, you're not. But if you merge with Hudson, two things would happen. One is, I would then go to the state first and say, hey, as a city in Columbia County in a new merging city, we need these resources to come in order to have proper traffic flow through this city. We need to have this route fixed. And you can advocate a little harder. But if they didn't do that, I would then go to the county and say, you should pay for it because this is the main economic artery going through Columbia County. And as Hudson goes economically, so goes the county. I believe 60 to 70% of the revenue, tax revenue generated in Columbia County is generated between Hudson and Greenport. So it would behoove you to want traffic to flow through that area much better, right? And if that's the case, if I'm able to bring the tax rate down in the new city of Hudson, well, where are new businesses going to look to locate? Where the taxes are lower. And as new businesses come, more residents are going to want to come. And then you're going to have new affordable housing that we hopefully get in the prison. If you put those two together, you change the whole dynamic of Columbia County.
All right. Thank you for outlining that. That all seems like a very ambitious plan. I hope I'll hear more about the think tank in the future. I did just want to go back and ask more, sort of a more personal question, just going back to something that you said when we were talking about your attempt at military service and how that was cut short because of your vision issues. But you mentioned that you were mad at the world, but also that you were mad at God. Mm-hmm. Is your face a big part of your life?
It is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I pray every day. My mom was a trustee of Shiloh Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. My entire family was a member of Shiloh Baptist Church. And it's a real salt. Like, that's a real, like, I'm not going to let any harm if I can. Like, if I hear, like, any government agencies or whatever trying to come, I'm just not going to allow it. As long as I have any breath, Shiloh will always have a spark in my heart. And not because it's a church. It represents a part of our community. Really, the black population seems to be getting away from this. But when I was growing up, when we wanted to have information disseminated in the community, it was through the church. When we want to have community gatherings and they were doing like cake sales outside and all that, it was through the church. When we started doing family trips to Florida, Disneyland, all that, it was through the church. So all my experiences, really fond experiences, came through my relationship with the church. And as I got older, I got away from it. And once I got married, I had to bring myself back to it.
Is your wife also a Baptist?
Oh, she's way more. She doesn't go to Shiloh so much because she's been more time in Albany, but she's very religious, more so than I am even. Mm.
How long have you and your wife been married?
Don't let me not get this wrong. 22 years. Since 2003.
Right around the same time that you got involved in politics.
Right around the same time I got involved.
How did you two meet?
So she was coming from Nigeria. This is really good. So she was coming from Nigeria. And I, by this time, I'm working at the county. I'm making good money. I'm single, a real eligible bachelor. And so every weekend, I used to go up to Albany. Sometimes doing political stuff, I go to the library and research. But every time I went there, I would see her there. Every time. And I finally got the nerve to go over, and I was like, I see you in here all the time. And, you know, we would talk and all that. And I came in one day, and I said, you know, could we go to dinner or something like that? And she was telling me how she was so busy with school, which flew over my head, right? Because I'm like, school, I hated school. Right? And so, you know, I'm going, what kind of school could she be doing? And she was like, but I'll give you my phone number. So she gave me her phone number, and we would spend hours on the phone talking. And I eventually was like, can we go to dinner? And she always teased me about this, because our first date was at Olive Garden, which she hates. She hates Olive Garden with a passion. But she went and she ate the meal, and we had a good time. But she tells me now how she really hated it. And we became best friends. She's my best friend. You know, outside of my support, you know, because I, you know, with being in politics, you go through things. And I went through a lot of arguments and, you know, people talking about me in the street and all that. And she was, her and my mom, and my sister too, my sister Wanda, but my wife and my mom were like my biggest offenders. They were like, you know, you couldn't really, and sometimes she's kind of bothered me because you couldn't say much negative about me because they would be like, you know. So yeah, she's my biggest defender and my best friend.
That's very sweet. Thank you for sharing that with me. Is there anyone else in your life that you kind of wanted to highlight as support? And that can be family or friends or political allies.
Yeah, so, in politics, it's funny because it's hard to build allies in politics, right? People think that they can, but the truth of the matter is a lot of people, unfortunately, is there for what it could give them or get them versus how they can help you. That's the unfortunate part. And a lot of people won't admit it, but it's true. And so when I was there, I never wanted to be there to ingratiate myself or even my family. Not that I hadn't, right? Because sometimes I help the family, but I was always very, very, very cognizant and careful about helping others. So I say that to say is when I joined the Board of Supervisors, I had I primaried someone who was a longstanding, respected person in this community, which was Stanley Keefe. And I don't know if you know you heard of Mr. Keefe, but he's a very prominent black man in this community. And we had started this organization called HALA. Well, I didn't start it, they started it. And at that time, I was a Republican. And I had only became a Republican because of the job and so forth. I really wanted to move away from the party, but I didn't know how. And you had a few people in the community that were prominent citizens in the community, but also elected officials as Democrats. And so they started this organization called HALA, and they invited me to be a part of it. But every meeting I came into, it was an attack, you know, so assassination on Bill. Here he comes again, that damn Republican, and you don't do this for the community, and you know, you're really making the community look bad, and how can a black man? And it was, you know, every meeting, I showed up every meeting on this. But then in that meeting, it was decided that Quentin Cross and myself were gonna now run for supervisor as a tandem, as a team. And as we were going through that is when, you know, Mr. Cross had gotten into all his trouble with the city. And, you know, I was still running. And so they approached me and asked me if I would back out. And I said, wait, but you guys had already decided almost a year ago that this is what we were going to do. But since now that Quentin isn't running, I already submitted my petitions. So now you're telling me I too should back out? And they were like, well, yeah, we'll find something else for you to do. And I was like, well, I don't want to do something else. I wanted to run for county supervisor. And I didn't tell you this part of it, is I wanted to run for county supervisor because when I worked for the county, I ended up suing the county for racial discrimination and disability discrimination. I played my own lawyer, and I actually won the lawsuit, I won the judgment from EEOC. And the county was upset about that. And so it wasn't a monetary, so there was no financial settlement, but what it was is a whole lot of terms. Like, they had to make the building accessible and more bright. So I needed more light because for me, having glaucoma. And so I got to walk around the building and say where I needed more light, which was going to cost them a substantial amount of money. So I was walking through the hallway going, I need some light here. Yeah, I think I need some light over here. And did I really need all of it? You know, but they gave me such a hard time, I figured I'm going to cost you some money, right? So they put the lighting in. The other thing that was is they gave me a choice of I could come back to 401, which is where I originally worked, or I could stay at the building where they transferred me, which was the courthouse. And I was like, well, I'm going to stay at the courthouse because I think now I had made so many enemies. If I went back to 401, which the administrative building where all the heads were, they were going to ignore me and make my life hell anyway. So I was like, I'm not going to subject myself to that. At this time, the people in the courthouse are really kind of liking me now. They're used to me. They're not bothering me. Not my best friend, but they're not bothering me. So I could survive out my days here. That was my thinking. So I decided, I told you, I'll stay here. And so I'm thinking that everything went away, right? You know, everything is good and fine and so forth. And about 6 months later, they submit me with this paper and said, we want you to take an individual medical exam. And I was like, you know, they don't just do anything. So I was like, there's something to this. So I read the notes and find out that if I had gone to a doctor and that doctor determined that I physically was not able to perform that duty, the duties of that job, that they could release me on the spot. And it was something that's called like physical determination. And I was like, oh no. Because as I told you in my story, when they hired me, I had no physical, no interview, no job title. There was no physical. You didn't give me a physical. Everybody in the world knew I was, by this time, knew that I had glaucoma and that I had a visual impairment. There was nobody in my circle that didn't know. So they knew, right? And that's why if I go take a medical exam, I'm 100% going to fail. I knew I was going to fail. So I said, I'm not going to do it. And they said, well, we're going to make you. And they hired a lawyer and all this. And so I approached the union because I didn't feel comfortable enough fighting this myself. And they got me a lawyer. So my lawyer is fighting up with their lawyer. And it was getting pretty heated to the point where I was thinking I was going to lose this battle. So I said, you know what? I'm going to have to get ahead of this. Along me reading these notes, I also read and I came across this thing about disability retirement, which I never heard of and never thought about. You know, I was someone who was, like I told you, I worked three jobs at one time. I never thought about disability. What is that? Right? And so where it says you need to get in 10 years. And I was like, wow, how many years do I have? I must be close. So I had my mom drive me up to 110 State Street up here in Albany, where the retirement is. And I go in there and I said, excuse me, can you tell me how much time I have towards my retirement? And the woman goes in the back and she comes out and she says, you have about 9 years and like 7 months, something like that. She said, you need about 2.5 more months of time. And I said, okay, great. So I go back And I tell my lawyer, I said, look, oh, in between then, I have an eye doctor that I go to every 4 months for glaucoma, even still now. I drove over to his office, which was probably 2 miles from 110, right across the road. And I went and I asked him if he could give me a letter saying that I was not able to perform the duties of my job anymore. And he was very hesitant. He said, well, why would I give you a letter like that, Bill? And I said, well, the county already wrote me a letter saying that, you know, we recommend that you go get this physical because we as a county find that you are not able to perform the duties of your job anymore. And I said, well, so the county wrote this letter, so I want you to write a letter substantiating what they said. And he goes, well, why would I do that? I said, because I'm going to apply for disability retirement. So he writes this letter for me. I take them and I set it aside. I then go back to my lawyer and I said, hey, I just need us to stall this for 3 months. And he was like, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, my doctor is going to give me all these medical exams. So have the judge allow me to go through the medical exams with my doctor first, and then I'll take the medical exam with their doctor. So I'm not saying I won't take their exam. I'm just saying I need time. Let my doctor examine me first. And he said, okay, so we'll see. So we go in, and they're going, oh, you know, they're going up, and they, Your Honor, we want him to do this. And it was this really pretty black woman. Her name was Dion. I won't forget her name. She was stunning. Like, looked like Halle Berry, kind of pretty. And I was shocked, right? Because when I walked in, I'm going in and I'm like, oh, they got a black woman lawyer now? Like, oh my God. You know, they pulled out all the tricks. And so I go in there and my lawyer was like, Your Honor, my client has agreed to their test, but he wants to have his doctor examine him first. And the judge was like, okay, I can see that. And she immediately jumped up and go, absolutely not. We want him to be examined right now. And the judge was like, look, I can't say, but it looks like you guys are targeting this young man. So I'm going to allow his doctors to examine him first, and then you can give him all the tests you want. And she's like, well, how much time are you going to need? I said, at least 3 to 3.5 months. Oh, my God. And they, like, put on a big theatrical act and all that. And we walk out. And so I had all this sick time build up. So what I would do is I would go to work, and I would call in sick at least 2 days a week. Right? Because now they're on me. They're, like, trying to – he's taking lunch too long. And they're trying to find any little thing, right? And I was like – I'm gonna just waste all my sick time until. So once the 3 months was up, I had my mom drive me back up there. She was like, you need one more week. And I was like, oh my God. So I go back and I call in sick like four times this week, right? And then they send me this thing in the mail. You now reach your retirement date. So I was like, did I reach it? Did I reach it? She was like, you have 10 years and so many days, she told me I had. I said, okay, great. And I handed her the 2 pieces of paper and I said, I'd like to file for disability retirement. And she was like, what? I said, yeah, I want to file for disability. She was like, are you sure? And I gave her both the letters and she read them and she said, okay. She went in the back, she got a stamp thing, stamped them. She said, sign here. I signed it. And I said, what else? She said, you're officially retired. I said, thank you very much. I walked out. I went home. I folded all my uniforms. I walked up to my office, I put them on my boss's desk, and I said, I officially retire. And it was like, you can't retire, you didn't take our physical. And I said, oh, I don't need to. I was like, I'm to retire. And so the union calls me up and was like, Bill, can you please? I said, why should I? Well, I'm not looking to do any favors. Why should I go take their physical? They put me through hell. And he was like, please. And I was like, all right, I'll go take the physical. So I know I'm gonna fail anyway. So I go in there, and the doctor's doing this peripheral thing, and he was like, and I couldn't see anything, right? Not even thinking. And he was like, you know what? Get out of here. I'll go get your records from your eye doctor. You failed. Which is what I knew. It wasn't like it was going to be rocket science. So at that same time, while all that was happening, when is they were trying to talk me out of not running for supervisor, and I wanted to run for supervisor because I was going to be these people's boss. So those people that put me through all of that, I now are going to be their boss. So I decided that I wouldn't that I would still run for supervisor, which kind of made Mr. Keith mad. And I felt bad about that, but he was the one that pushed me towards it, but he wanted me to back out at the end. And by me staying in, means I was going to have to primary him. And when I did, you know, I got 90% of the vote, and he ended up losing, right? And I had a lot of admiration for him, but I thought it was an agreement. Like, we were going to do this, so I was like, I'm going to move forward with the agreement. And so when I won and I walked into the Democratic caucus, the first day I walked in, Doug McGivney was the minority leader. And he says, "So you the new guy?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He goes, "Well, we like the old guy better." And I said, "Oh." And I said, "Well, I'm sorry to hear that, but I think you'll come to like me too." And he said, "We shall see." And so my first week, after I got sworn in, I walked into the county attorney's office, because now I'm looking for get back, right? So I walked into the county attorney's office and I said, "I want a list of all the people that are on your ethics board." And they were like, "Oh my God." They were like, "What do you want that for?" I just want it. I was like, I need you to give me a copy of all the people on your ethics board. I don't need any questions from you because this is the county attorney's office." And they're like, "Well, I'm not sure we can give that to you." And I say, "Really? Well, you call the chairman up right now and you tell him what I'm looking for. And you don't want to give it to me, then I'll take the next step." So he calls me up. At the time, it was Mr. Keegan. And he was like, "What are you looking for that for, Bill?" I said, "I want to see the names on the ethics board. Are you going to give it to me or not? Because if you aren't, my next call is to the Register Star, the Times Union, News Center 6, 10, 13, and everybody else. So am I going to get it or I'm not going to get it?" So they give me the list. And the reason why they didn't want to give me the list is because a couple people on the list were either A, deceased, or hadn't been active on that committee for years, which means that committee wasn't active for years. So then I sat down and started rewriting the county's ethics policy. And I took like the New York State policy, I researched all the surrounding counties and what they had in their ethics policy, and I rewrote the Columbia County's ethics policy. And I submitted it, and they were like, "Oh no, we're not voting on this thing." And I was like, "Well, why not?" And they were like, "You're no lawyer." I said, "Well, is it bad written?" "Well, no, we don't know. We need to have a lawyer review it." So they assigned me to this lawyer named Dan Tuzinski. And Dan says, "Bill, I'm going to sit down with you and write it." And he takes my paper and he goes, "All this red lines, not this, not this, not." I said, "Oh, what are you doing there?" And he was like, "They're not going to accept any of it." I said, "I'm not here to debate with you on what they're going to accept and not accept. I'm just sitting here to make sure I have the legal language right." And he says, "Bill, do you want this to pass or don't you?" And I said, "I absolutely want it to pass." I said, "But I spent months on writing this thing. And you come in here in a couple hours and you're redlining the whole." He said, "You know what? I'm going to assign my assistant, his name is Brent Stack, to sit here and work with you. It's going to take some time, but you guys have come up with a version that will be acceptable to the Republicans and the Democrats." And I said, "Okay, I'll work on it with you. But Dan, if this thing goes right, not left, if it goes right, I'm telling you, I'm going to have a problem with it." So we came up with a version that was much softer, but still a few changes that was much softer than what I was looking for initially. And they wouldn't let me bring it through committee. They were like, "You're going to have to bring it off the floor." Which, when you bring something off the floor, you first have to get 3/4 of a vote to decide on whether they're going to allow it to go for a vote. And then you have to get a majority of the people to vote for it to pass. So I called all the news channels, the ones that I just mentioned, and said, "Hey, we're going to be voting on a resolution to reestablish the ethics committee in Columbia County." And I rewrote the ethics policy for that to happen. And I think that the Republicans are going to oppose it. So when they saw all the news cameras come in, I introduced it, Ed Cross seconded it, and we brought it off the floor. And they all voted to now allow it to go for a vote. And then when it came up for a vote, it passed unanimously. And so we had a new ethics policy in Columbia County. And that was my first thing I did because I was pissed off at the Republicans of how they treated me. Right? And within there, if you look in the Columbia County's ethics policy, I wrote what they call an Employee's Bill of Rights. And that specifically speaks to how they treated me. And I was like, you're never going to treat another person like this again.
That is a really fascinating and very satisfying story. We are drawing close to the end of our allotted time, but before I let you go, is there anything else you wanted to share for the archive? Any memories, plans, inspiration for the future of Hudson?
Not really, other than, you know, Hudson is a great place to live. And we have gone through, in my lifetime, three iterations. Different life changes in Hudson as far as the economics and the build of the city. And I see a fourth one ahead. And I think that the future is bright for Hudson as long as our new leaders who are in charge are willing to roll their sleeves up and work with everybody. We have to put the letter behind the name, our parties aside, and we have to work for the greater good.
All right, Bill, thank you so much for joining me today. This has been lovely talking to you.
This has been fun. I enjoyed it.